This is not a story of my denomination, because I'm not part of any denomination. Now, it's hard to do what I'm going to do without it looking like denominations. Because you talk about what people do and what groups of people do, and it turns in, you make a chart, and it sure looks like a duck, you know. It looks like a denomination. And a part of the reason it looks like a denomination is because a lot of it is a denomination. That is, there are a lot of people in it who think about it denominationally. But that's not what I am. And it's actually a repudiation of denominationalism if you look at the message itself, to say that what we want to do is be undenominational Christians. So it is not a story of my denomination. And no matter how much it looks like it, when we get there, that's not what I'm talking about. It's not a morality tale about what should be. I'll tell you what history is. History is not a story about what ought to be. It's a story about what has been. We have an interesting dichotomy at my house. I'm in charge as a historian at my house of what has happened. My wife is in charge of what ought to have happened. So if I come home and say such and such happened, and she'll say, well, they shouldn't have done that. I said, I didn't say they should have done it. I just said they did it, you know. So when we talk about history, I'm not recommending a lot of the things that we're going to be talking about. I'm not saying this is what we should have. What I'm saying is this is what people did do. And so that can be fairly instructive. Now, let me just put another little preface on this and talk for a moment about the value of history other than it gives me a job. A lot of times people say, well, why do we study history anyhow? What use is history? I think maybe the most important thing about history is it simply tells you where you are. You know, you can't understand where you are unless you understand that you got there. You know, there are a lot of young people, particularly, I think, who get the idea that there's nothing before and nothing after them. They just sprung up right there like that. But that's not true. You know, where we are is a product of a lot of things. And some of them good, some of them bad. And lots of times, history can teach us things in the sense that we think about things, we think we're the first people ever thought about that. Actually, a lot of people have thought about it before. And it's useful to know what people in the past have thought about. We're not wedded to that. We're not loyal to any person or tradition or anything else. But it's useful for us to know it. This congregation here is here as a result of historical experience. There are things that have happened over the last 25, 30 years that make this congregation what it is today. Doesn't make it right, doesn't make it wrong, doesn't mean it'll stay there, but you have to understand where you are by understanding how you got to where you are. Does history repeat itself? Well, I'll give you an answer to that. Yes and no. The answer is, yes, only in this sense. There are certain institutional patterns that tend to appear repetitiously in history. There's certain kinds of evolutions take place over and over again. I've used a lot of sociological models in the writing that I've done, because sociologists try to put patterns on everything, and they'll say, this has happened like it's happened before, and this is what's going to happen next. And there are a lot of things that you can do with that. There are a lot of truths that you can grasp, and we're going to look at some of those. But, I mean, you can say nations progress, you know, from pioneer periods into more established periods into decadent periods, and that certain kind of changes tend to take place. You know, businesses do the same thing. They have businesses that start as kind of innovative, and then they become bureaucratic, and then they become decadent. So there are many models that seem as if There are certain patterns that happen over and over again. And that there's nothing new under the sun. So, sometimes we can kind of look for things that might be fairly predictable that are going to happen. On the other hand, the answer to, does the history repeat itself? The answer is, no, it doesn't repeat itself. Same thing never happens again. The same thing never happens again because the same people never around again. And so, there are always differences. There's an interesting difference between individual conduct and organizational conduct. Organizations tend to behave predictably. Institutions do. That is, they evolve in certain ways. Individuals behave very unpredictably. So that you can never predict how a particular person, sometimes they'll act in their self-interest, sometimes they don't act in their self-interest. Sometimes people make choices that are unexpected. That's why in this last book that I wrote, I decided to try something that was different because I theoretically thought about these issues for a while. And the book is entitled, as most of you know, The Churches of Christ in the 20th Century, Homer Haley's Personal Journey of Faith. And I combined the institutional history of Churches of Christ in the 20th Century with the personal biography of Homer Haley, who's lived the whole 20th Century. And it's interesting, see, to superimpose those two things. That the churches behave in one way. But an individual, all of us, when you write a history of a nation, you don't write the history of what all the people in that nation did. Nobody in that nation does what you read. I've just finished writing the history of the United States. And it's not anybody's history, actually. Every individual has a different history. Same thing's true in churches. All of us make our choices, but we make them within the framework of that. So individuals are different, all right? Now, let's go on, and I'm going to just get us kind of started this morning on restoration antecedents. What we're going to be talking about is a kind of an identifiable movement of people who set out in the early 19th century in the United States saying what we want to do is restore the church, go back to New Testament patterns. And that is a concrete thing that we can easily trace because it just has a historical continuity about it. But if one asks the question, is this then where the concept of restoration starts? It starts in the early 19th century in the United States? Well, of course not. I mean, the idea of going back and just being a New Testament Christian is just an obvious idea. I would think people have thought of it all through the years. In fact, I think it's a property of the human mind. We do it in all kinds of ways, you know. There are a lot of people, politicians running around the United States today saying what we need to do is go back and be like we were in the days of the founding fathers, you know. Or people in their businesses say we need to take this business back and get it back to the first principle. Well, people just think that way. That's obvious. So to the concept of saying we pick up a lot of baggage and corruption and things that are wrong, and what we ought to do is just go back and be like it was in the beginning of Christianity. That's an idea that nobody thought of for the first time in the 19th century in America. It's an idea that's in the air, that's out there. So, there are many other restorationist and primitivist movements. Now, historians will use that term primitivist to talk about these movements today, and all that means is going back to the primitive church. As I say, you could go back and look at that concept and just find it all over the place. You can find it in the Reformation. I mean, the people in the Reformation spoke in restorationist terms very strongly. Do you know, by the way, that the term Reformation is really a restoration term? I've heard through the years some people say, well, the difference was in the Reformation they wanted to reform the Catholic Church, and in the Restoration the concept was to go back and restore the New Testament Church. But actually that's not quite accurate. I'll tell you what Martin Luther and those other guys meant when they said they were going to reform. They meant that they wanted to go back and reform the Church of the first century. So, I mean, they had a restorationist idea. The Puritans, you read Puritan literature in England and America, and it is absolutely just full of restoration ideas. Now, the thing is, they don't do a very good job sometimes. I mean, they'll say we're going to go back and just be primitive Christians, and they don't look much like it to me. So the application of the concept and the concept, two different things. I wonder sometimes how good I do at it, too. I do the best I can. I don't know whether they did the best they can or not. But that's what it's about. You certainly read the language. You read it in English separatism. You read it in Scottish separatism. I just quoted this from the Westminster Confession of Faith. This is the great English Puritan creed of 1636. You can see how the idea permeates it. The whole counsel of God concerning all things necessary for his own glory, man's salvation, faith, and life is either expressly set down in Scripture or by good and necessary consequences may be deduced from Scripture, unto which nothing at any time is to be added, whether by new revelations of Spirit or traditions of men. I'm by that. I mean, it looks like if that's the principle that I'm after, that if you follow that principle, it ought to get you to the right place. And then I like that next section too. All things in Scriptures are not alike plain in themselves, nor alike clear unto all. Yet those things which are necessary to be known, believed, and observed for salvation are so clearly propounded and opened in some place of Scripture or the other, that not only the learned but the unlearned, in a due use of the ordinary means, may attain it unto a sufficient understanding of it. I mean, they recognize that you're not going to agree about everything. Now, we'll talk about that later on. That's one. The concept of restoration is an untidy concept. That is, I'll tell you what you have to do, and this kind of predicts some of the things I'm going to be talking about. You can either say, we got it all right, and here's what you have to do is tell what the all is that we got right. And then you have to write a creed. And a lot of folks are good at that. But through the centuries, lots of folks have done that. So you can either do that. But there's a lack of reality to that. Or what you have to do is say, well, this is important and this is unimportant. And the question is, who has the authority to do that? Or you can say that we recognize that we commit ourselves to following the Scriptures. But sometimes that's tough. And everything's not absolutely clear. Now, the fact that everything's not absolutely clear doesn't mean that some things are absolutely clear. And so that's what they said. They said, and that's kind of been a rule of thumb that I've used to say that there's a kind of a sense of clarity and common sense application of it that keeps us together and it makes us a viable kind of plea. But those are all things we're going to talk about later on. Now, I'm not going to talk about these guys, but they're a lot of interesting. This is one of the old Scottish, here's a Scottish Presbyterian, a man of some substance. Robert Sandeman, who left the Presbyterian Church. His people were generally called Sandemanians. They're still around. Some American early Restoration leaders came out of this movement. They just said, we're going to go back and try to just be Christians. This fellow was more significant as a Scottish precedent for the Restoration movement. James Haldane, who they established lots of churches in England. Generally, they're called Old Path churches. By the way, if you go to an Old Path church in England, they'll let you know in a hurry that they didn't come from America. That they preceded the American Restoration Movement. And Haldane had a little school in Glasgow that Alexander Campbell, when Alexander Campbell's father, Thomas Campbell, came to America before him, in 1808, I believe it was, Alexander Campbell went to Glasgow and spent a year in Glasgow, went to Glasgow University. And by the way, I'll tell you a quick story about that. I like to go to Scotland because I like to do research over there. I went to Glasgow University one time, and I was just to see if I could find Alexander Campbell there, because I'd read that he had been there, but I wanted to try to document that. So I went and started looking in the class rolls at Glasgow University, and I'll tell you what I discovered. About one-third of the students were named Alexander Campbell. That was a common name. But anyhow, I did find him. He did go. But while he was there, this guy and his brother, James Haldane and his brother, were running a little Bible school. He also went to that. And Haldane, for instance, was the one from whom Campbell got the idea that New Testament churches took the Lord's Supper every first day of the week, and that they were congregations with elders over every congregation. He got his congregational ideas. So there was a kinship between those people from the beginning. All right, now, here are the other antecedents, and that's about all we're going to get today. When you talk about the idea of restoring New Testament Christianity, it's not something, if our lesson this morning maybe would be, it's not something that's the property of one person. It's not an idea that somebody just thought of. People, before it came to America, thought of it. Other Americans thought of it. It's an idea that just pops up all over early 19th century America. And there's a group in New England that adopted restorationist concepts and said we just ought to go back and call ourselves Christians. This is a North Carolina group led by a man named James O'Kelly. It came out of the Methodist Church. They were called Republican Methodists for a while. Eventually what came out of it was a church called the Christian Connection Church. They were the ones that first started using the name Christian widely. All right, let's just run through these first generation leaders. I just thought I'd show you some pictures. That's Thomas Campbell and Martin Stone's pictures. Thomas Campbell came to America. He was a Presbyterian preacher in Northern Ireland. Came to America in 1807, I think. Can't remember all that stuff exactly. I need to read my books again. But I'll tell you what I tell my students in my history classes at the first time. Sometimes, don't trust me too much on the facts. If I come to something and I can't remember it, I just make something up. So it's always good to double check. He got in trouble with the Presbyterian Church shortly after he came, and in 1809, he and a group of about 30 people separated and formed the Christian Association of Washington, they called themselves, and wrote a publication called the Declaration and Address. It's just a wonderful little pamphlet in which they said, we're just going to be Christians. And we're just going to speak where the Bible speaks. We don't want any creed or anything else. So that was interesting. Martin Warren Stone was a Presbyterian church. Was a Presbyterian preacher. Preached in Kentucky. He was the priest at this congregation, Cane Ridge, Kentucky. And there were a whole series of famous camp meetings in early 19th century America. This was the most famous of them. About 30,000 people came to this meeting. And these fellows just preached in the open air, and they were pretty biblical. But they consequently got in trouble with the Presbyterian Church because they were trying to get people to be converted. And consequently, in 1807, there were six Presbyterian preachers in the Springfield Presbytery in Kentucky. They wrote a famous document called The Last Will and Testament of the Springfield Presbytery, in which they said, we're going to kill the Springfield Presbytery died. We're just going to call ourselves Christians from now on. Stone edited this paper, The Christian Messenger, for a long time. That's the old Cane Ridge meeting house. And next year, they're having 200 century celebration of Cane Ridge Revival. And I'm going to speak at Cane Ridge about Barton Stone's contribution to the American Restoration Movement. And that's Alexander Campbell. We'll be talking about Campbell some more. He came in 1809. He came to the U.S. His father was already here. He was 21 years old. He'd been studying with Haldane in Scotland, and he picked up some of these ideas, and he was afraid his father wasn't going to like it. His father had seceded from the Presbyterian Church and formed this independent association. He was afraid his son wouldn't like it. And so they got together, and they both liked it. And so pretty soon, Alexander Campbell became the leader of this movement. In 1815, they became Baptists because he became convinced that baptism was immersion. And from 1853, really, until about 1827 or so, he was stated a Baptist, but they were not very good Baptists, which most Frontier Baptists were not. That is, they were pretty independent. He edited a magazine from 1823 to 1830 called The Christian Baptist, in which he very radically called people back to just being Christians. Wrote a long series of articles that was quite influential called The Restoration of the Ancient Order of Things, in which he tried to outline what New Testament churches were like. And they're still quite influential. Good. Okay, he lived to 1866. You can tell which picture was the old one. He did a lot of things. By the way, he held some really high-level debate. Held the only debate in American history with a Roman Catholic cardinal. He debated Archbishop John Purcell in Cincinnati. He also debated the most famous atheist of his day, Robert Owen, in Cincinnati, 1829. Oh, there's some other first-generation leaders. Now, this will just set us up for next time. Really what I want to discuss with you is my kind of my theoretical framework of restoration history. I'll tell you basically what if you go back to this movement in the early 19th century, from there in 200 years, there essentially it has been through five phases that are quite different. The first phase of this first generation leaders, the people I'm telling you about, from 1800 to 1865, almost all of them died about that time. Campbell died in 1865, Walter Scott died in 68, Stone had died earlier. Most of these guys died. And the phase two is from 1865 to 1906 for Churches of Christ. It really stretches up to about 1950 for the other group. And let me show you one more slide here. And this is what we'll be talking about next time. I will break the history of the movement now. What happens to these people that set out to restore New Testament Christianity into five phases? First phase, my time's up. I think it is.
45.
Yeah. Isn't that what I'm supposed to do? Okay. Well, memorize this for tomorrow. What you have is these first phase that we'll talk about real quickly, the lessons we can learn from that. Then the second phase, what happens is it divides. And there's just three quite distinct religious communities that come out of it. And then we'll look at the history of the Churches of Christ, which is one of those phases. And they go through a third phase in which they grow. And then, from 1950 to the present, the Churches of Christ have divided into three quite distinct communities, separated from one another. And then, the fifth phase for non-institutional Churches of Christ is what has happened since. Okay, we'll begin our lesson there tomorrow.